Hi, this is Cecily Armstrong. Thank you for listening to this week's show on your favorite podcast platform. You can go to our website, grapesgrainscrub.com, for pictures, stories, recipes, music, and extras about this episode and other episodes, delicious travel ideas, my culinary picks, and a lot more. Okay, so let's get started. I hope you enjoy this week's episode. You're listening to Grapes, Grains, and Grub, where we believe agriculture tastes good. And I'm your host, Cecily Armstrong. Today, my very special guest is award-winning chef, restaurateur, and seafood expert, Carrie Heffernan. He has been cooking professionally since age 15 in Europe and at New York City's most heralded restaurants, including Montrachet, Restaurant Bouilly, the famed Polo, which is where we actually met, to 1 Fifth Avenue, to 11 Madison Park, to Southgate, and now Grand Banks, to name a few. You know this CIA alum, where he gave the commencement speech in 2012, by the way, from his frequent TV appearances, including Top Chef All-Stars, The Today Show, Good Morning America, Martha Stewart, CBS, and CNN. He is known for supporting many organizations through his philanthropy and seafood sustainability and conservation advisement, like City Harvest Food Council, Share Our Strength, and both the Central Park and Madison Square Park Conservancies. It would take me the rest of the show to tell you more about this dad, fisherman, and race car loving chef, so you can find his bio on our website, along with all the pictures and more. It's always great to be able to interview a friend that I respect so much, and today's conversation focuses on seafood and ocean sustainability. Also, his tips for all of us on how to select seafood, a really fantastic sauce recipe of his, and his recent unexpected whale encounter with his good friend, Tom Colicchio. I also ask him about fatherhood and how he discusses the state of our ocean's future with his sons.
All the oysters go through a pretty rigorous monitoring, and they have a tag that accompanies the animal from harvest to sale. So if anything ever happened and you kept your receipt or whatever that said, I bought wealthy oysters at Whole Foods on this date, they could then take that, and if there was any issue, they could trace it back to the person who grew the oyster, and then they would actually be the ones who would be able to be liable or to tell you about what might have happened if there was any issue.
Later in the show, we revealed this episode's culinary destination and my picks this week, including a Tex-Mex cookbook by San Antonio native turned Los Angeles superstar that includes authentic flavors of South Texas with an unexpected twist, like a vegan cashew-based queso with charred onion, garlic, and green chili. Yum. And a couple of other items I'm really loving right now. But before we get to my conversation with Carrie Heffernan, here's our weekly front of house segment with entertaining and hospitality expert Robert Rodriguez. He's sharing his professional inside scoop and tips about the importance of lighting during your next dinner or event. Taking us from front of house to your house on every episode of Grapes, Grains, and Grub. Cecily Armstrong here with one of my favorite people that I'm staring at in the studio right now with anticipation, Robert Rodriguez. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Well, I'm great. I love it when you come to the studio because we get to really share some cool information. You know, it's a little bit different when you're in the studio. So, and we are in a studio today that you just said is exemplifying what we're talking about, which is lighting.
Yes, you're looking fabulous in this lighting today.
Thank you. We said it perfectly before you got here. We were hoping we did the right thing. So let's talk about it because it's one of those things that's simple to do, doesn't really cost anything or much, right? And
yes.
But people just forget about it.
They do.
Why?
Lighting is one of those things that is so simple, doesn't cost you anything. It's very, you know, inexpensive, but people often forget it. And sometimes you walk into an environment and it's very bright and very harsh, and brash is one of the words that comes to mind for me a lot of the times. there's several different ways to look at lighting, and one is the level itself, and that's one thing that can present a warm and welcoming environment immediately as soon as you walk into the environment, or it can be very harsh and brash and off-putting as soon as you walk into that environment. So that's one thing that's important to consider, and that's the easiest to control because you can add it or take it away. Install dimmers on switches where you would like the room to appear warmer rather than so bright. That way you have control of it. Look at that room during the morning, the afternoon, the evening, so that way you know on your dimmer in advance where to place that and have control over the environment. Know where candles can be placed to control the lighting in that room as well, and how the room looks with peripheral lighting, like lamps in the corners or on the sides, so that you always have control over what's going on in that room and you know exactly how to provide for your guests. Always consider the source of your lighting, whether it's a flame that flickers from a candle or from a fire, like an open pit in the backyard, or if it's a solid light that's dimmed to provide a constant light. Constant light is great when you're looking at food, like on a food display at your home. You do want to have some of that constant light. So make sure you look at the source of the light and the type of the light that you need to provide for your guests. Another thing that you can look at is the location of the lighting. Where is that light coming from and what does it highlight? Overhead lighting can tend to be very harsh, and I recommend keeping that very low. That's something that I do, is keep that very low and then have lighting come in from the side, whether it's lamps or candles or things like that, or below. A lot of times candles are below someone's face. So you have all these different sources of light throughout the environment, and you want to highlight the positive and definitely cut down on the negative. So a lot of times it's on the fly. A lot of times you need to look at the environment during your setup to run a little test to say, hey, this is the time of day it's going to be. This is the amount of light that's going to be in this room naturally. And what do I need to do to highlight it to make people look fantastic in this situation? Lighting can definitely affect your mood, whether it's bright and light outside for like a lunch or a brunch, or whether it's intimate and dark and kind of glowing for a more formal or a more intimate experience. And it's important, you know, even at home, you can have different lighting and different moods in different areas. So keep that in mind, whether it's indoor or outdoor, or whether it's in the kitchen where you want everyone to see everything, or if it's, you know, in a more intimate area that has more plush seating, maybe you want that to be a little darker and a more intimate, just candle lit. Maybe you don't need an overhead light. Maybe it's just a lamp in the corner, or maybe it's a few candles. So you can really customize spaces as you walk through an event to get a different look and a different feel and a different mood in each area where you're entertaining. That way everyone can settle in where they're comfortable.
Robert, once again, you have brought us up to speed on what we need to do to have a front of house experience at home, or maybe even, you know, in an office or at an organization when somebody's creating an event. Thank you so much.
Time to get back to work.
Today, I'm catching up with longtime friend, chef and restaurateur Kerry Heffernan of New York City. He's a very respected seafood sustainability expert with a major career, helming kitchens and operations for award-winning restaurants. He's also an avid fisherman, a traveler, a dad, and a TV star with a penchant for race cars. That's right. You're gonna like this guy. All right, so I do have Chef Kerry Heffernan on the phone here. I wish he was here in person, but I'll have to wait till I'm in New York next time. But it's great to talk with you. Where are you today, Kerry?
I'm here in New York aboard Grand Banks.
Oh my gosh, I'm so jealous. Tell our listeners what Grand Banks is.
So Grand Banks is the name of a restaurant that I currently run. It is sustainable seafood aboard a 1942 schooner named the Sherman's Wicker. And it's permanently moored in Tribeca, New York, and it's a pretty awesome place to come visit.
Yes, and you can go to our website and see pictures of it, and you will be booking your flight to New York City right away when you see that, and sitting there at the bar and eating oysters and having your favorite cocktail and chilling out. It's really incredibly delicious all the way around. Kerry, what gave you the idea to do a restaurant on a boat?
Well, I certainly can't say that it was my unique idea. The owners had actually done it for a season before they engaged me, but I think we've taken it to a new level. And now we have a second boat in Brooklyn called Pilot, and a land-based oyster bar on Governor's Island called Island Oyster. And we're planning a fourth venture as well.
No downtime for you these days. But it's never been downtime for you. So I'm going to, in the studio here earlier, our producers were asking, how do I know you? And I was thinking about the first time that we met was that short time, which it's not a hotel anymore, but I was living at the Westbury Hotel.
Yeah.
Me and my little dog, Pauline, and you fed Pauline many a time. She ate leftovers, but you were, of course, the executive chef at the famed Polo Lounge. And what a great place that was, and great experience. But that's how we got to know each other, because it was so interesting to me that you would, you know, after the bar closed down, the restaurant closed down, you'd pour yourself a cup of coffee and head out to Long Island Sound and catch a sea bass and come back. And that's what was for lunch or dinner the next day.
In a matter of speaking, absolutely.
That was great. Those were great times. So Carrie and I have known each other for a long time. And of course, his landmark career with fine establishments like 11 Madison Park and Southgate and his ventures now. What I can say about Carrie is, knowing him this long, is this thread of consistency of caring about seafood sustainability, what that means, and we're going to talk about that. And also the credibility of, where does the food come from? You can have these incredibly high-end restaurants, and some you think of high-end, but they're also casual. But that also means the food has to taste really good, and it has to come from a wonderful source that sometimes might be a family farm. Sometimes it might be a larger enterprise. It might be a fishing boat that you know the captain that you like to work with. But Carrie, you've spent a great deal of time as an award-winning chef really seeking out your purveyors.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we are lucky enough in New York to have a green market for, you know, 8 to 9 months out of the year. Actually, it's 12 months now with greenhouses and, you know, sort of advanced preservation technology. So we have access to produce within, say, 100 miles of New York City, which is actually pretty diverse in terms of fruits and vegetables and obviously wine and all sorts of things, as well as fish, and more and more to some extent, fish that's harvested in what they call recirculating aquaculture systems, which is kind of the future.
So what are the dangers? Let's just talk about that a little bit, that are happening for our oyster, what do we call them? Fields of oysters? They're not schools of oysters. What?
Bed.
A bed.
Beds would typically refer to wild oysters. And wild oysters occur on all three coasts, but mostly in the Gulf Coast is where you have the largest amount of wild oysters. So everything else is, I'd say 90-95% of what people are eating is farm raised in these places, you know, with some of the same ideas in mind as the original wild oyster. What's impacting water quality a great deal is the same thing that's impacting the planet, you know, rising temperature,
right?
The change in pH, and any other localized contaminations to the water. Now, the good thing for consumers is that oysters are probably among the most highly monitored of all fish. The sad truth is that only about 5% of the fin fish that comes through this country is actually inspected by the FDA. On the other hand, all the oysters go through a pretty rigorous monitoring, and they have a tag that accompanies the animal from harvest to sale.
Huh.
So if anything ever happened and you kept your receipt or whatever that said, I bought Wellfleet oysters at Whole Foods on this date, they could then take that. And if there was any issue, they could trace it back to the person who grew the oyster. And then they would actually be the ones who would be able to be liable or tell you about what might have happened if there was any issue.
That's a great tip for our listeners. Save your receipts. Look for those tags on those oysters when you make that purchase. Let's talk about, other than seafood, what we can look for and where do you think we're going in terms of feeding our world in a way that isn't depleting our natural resources in a safe way?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I think there has been, I almost want to say an awakening in sort of where we're going with, you know, land-based proteins and how the alternatives have become so available and frankly, tastier, that you're seeing, you know, Burger King with the Impossible Burger on its menu. And, you know, I don't know what the sales are, but I know that you can't get the Impossible Burger on a wholesale level right now because Burger King has basically contracted for it all.
Yeah, I found that out. That is an incredible mind shift and a commercial shift in our nation.
I mean, Meatless Mondays that, you know, is sort of taking hold, and the number of people who are embracing, you know, vegetarian and vegan diets. I'm not saying advocating for that entirely. I would be a little bored at this point to do that, but I think it's good to try it and to sort of, you know, get used to having that as an alternative in your routine. I know myself, I eat a great deal less red meat than I used to. That doesn't mean that I'm not having, you know, some pork and some chicken, you know, from time to time, but I'm lucky enough to have access to a lot of fresh fish. And, you know, I'm just looking at things in a bit of a different way, I suppose.
Right. Some of that's age, some of it's education, some of it's where you are. But, you know, at Grapes, Grains, and Grub, we say agriculture tastes good. And we really do mean that almost in a tongue-in-cheek sort of way, in that agribusiness means something in our beautiful United States and beyond, and we need to all be aware of it. Do you feel that there is a more of a consciousness in your customers that are coming into your various restaurants and the questions that they're asking?
Oh, I would say absolutely. I mean, you know, again, we have no meat on our menu, so except for in minor sauce touch here and there. So we don't really get, you know, people who are coming in looking for that. And we have several vegetarian options just as a sort of course of what we offer. But I would say the number of requests for that sort of thing and vegan, et cetera, you know, continues to grow. And I think it's just an awareness and a preference that people are seeing really almost as a variety, you know.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. Yeah.
Not as only, you know, it's a moral belief or whatever other factor may have chosen that for you. I'd say just try it for sake of variety, just to change things up.
So that's really brings me to another question for you is, as a chef, you know, you've been in this industry for really your whole life. When there's a big shift in a cultural belief system that translates to somebody's palate and to their wallet, how do you have to grow and change as a chef? Does it kind of reinvigorate you to take a look at recipes and invent new combinations of flavors? Or
absolutely. I think it's always good to sort of shake things up in any industry, and certainly ours is no different. The fact that we are challenged to produce things in different formats and, you know, sort of at different ratios and for different price points that include taking, you know, meat, fish, and even dairy out of the equation forces creativity, and it puts, you know, a burden of really energizing the creative process.
That sounds like fun.
It's always fun to be challenged, you know, and to have something new to try and, you know, stimulate what you do for a living. I mean, the one good thing I always say about fish is that there's so many different species that we are just learning, you know, sort of how to appreciate and consume. Not, we're certainly not the first ones to eat them, but we're maybe some of the first people that are making it popular to this audience is a way I would put it. For example, we serve porgy instead of striped bass at Grand Banks. We fry Atlantic dogfish, which is a kind of a shark, very sustainable, obviously, instead of cod at Island Oyster for the fish tacos. So in forcing myself to branch out and try these things, I am finding options that are often better than, you know, the thing that they were meant to substitute, which really becomes exciting. And of course, seaweed and sea vegetables. I mean, that is really kind of the future. If we could really look at, I always call it sort of Western interpretations of seaweed-based dishes, as opposed to the ones that we all sort of know, you know, like wakame salad and nori, et cetera. You know, kelp, if we are allowed, and this is going through FDA, et cetera, to farm more kelp in the Northeast, it is only going to benefit the environment. It is the second fastest growing plant in the world, second only to bamboo. So that means it grows at almost a foot a day under the right conditions. It metabolizes nitrogen from the water, which we, as I said, we have in excess. And it is basically a winter harvest. So lobster fishermen, you know, who don't get to go out as often in the winter could focus on this and have, you know, like a year round thriving business that is actually going to contribute to the environment.
It's so interesting. Last time that we had dinner together, we were talking about there's even fishermen, lobstermen that are sort of leaving that behind, but they're becoming sea farmers in kelp and other products. Do you see that growing?
You know, again, there's two challenges. One is in creating, and that is the chef's burden, the creating an environment for it in terms of creatively and in on the menu. And the second one is actually regulatory to some degree. And people are right to be careful about what we introduce into the environment, because the best laid plans of how to control things once they go in the water is often gone askew. I mean, the Asian carp is probably the greatest example.
So let me ask you, when you and your chef pals... I won't drop any names, but when you and your chef pals gather around, other than, you know, the non-working stuff that you talk about, is there more conversations happening about the future of food and how to satisfy customers and impact the bottom line? Because you are all in business after all, but having a kind of ethical backbone about it. Is this a subject that you find happens in private and personal conversations with other chefs in your industry?
Well, I'll tell you, and I'll give you an example. You know, I was out fishing, and I will drop names, with Tom Colicchio on Sunday, and we were looking for bluefin tuna, and the primary bait that they were on is something called sand eels, and the way you find them often is to find the whales, and to see the resurgence of whales and dolphins in the Northeast because of the fact that the fisheries managers are looking at the whole biomass, not just a specific species. In other words, how the bait impacts the predator species and everything in between. So they put in regulations to curb the whole scale reduction fisheries. And what that means is a fishery that goes out there and harvests tons and tons and tons of bait fish like menhaden or sand eels simply for the purpose of reducing it, hence the reduction, into fertilizer or cosmetics or whatever else. So these things are now much more abundant in the wild. And we've got this resurgence of humpback whales, right whales, pilot whales, finback whales. People have never seen whales from the beach in the Hamptons until the last couple of years. And now it's a common thing.
I've never seen that. I've been there a million times. I've never seen that. That's incredible.
You got to come soon because it's much more common to see that. And we found a pod of whales that looked like something out of Moby Dick, where we saw the blow spouts, which go 20 to 30 feet up in the air, which you can see from like 5 miles away. Maybe 8 to 10 or even 12 at once.
Oh.
You know, 50, 60 foot humpback whales feeding. And when we got there, you could get within like 10 feet of these animals and then cast to try and catch the tuna fish. And I'll tell you, my son, Teddy, who is 8, was aboard and he'd never seen anything like it. It was just, you know, awe inspiring.
How magical. How magical. I love that story. So how'd you do with the tuna?
I got one.
Okay. Did Tom get one?
He did not.
Oh, we got to call him out.
Well, you know, he's the captain. He was driving the boat, so I had a little bit more opportunity. So it's not entirely fair.
Why am I not surprised that Tom was the captain driving the boat?
Well, he's crazy about the offshore stuff. I'm much more of an inshore guy, so I have a small boat and he has a big boat. And, you know, it's his boat. He's going to drive. So,
Carrie, let's rewind a little bit and talk about the health of our oceans and the temperatures changing. You know, something that's affecting the Northeast coast as well as the Gulf Coast, of course, is red tide. How is that affecting, particularly you talked about, you know, wild oysters are predominantly on the Gulf Coast. And, you know, what's the state of the situation now?
Well, luckily, and I haven't really paid as much attention to the Gulf Coast, but luckily this year in the Northeast, we have not had any incidents, which is a little strange because water temperatures were high early. And that's usually, you know, an indicator of you're going to have problems with the red or rust tide. They've had a little bit more on the West Coast. And it's strange because the West Coast, the water temperatures are so much lower. You know, predominant oyster regions of the West Coast are Washington and British Columbia, a little bit of Oregon too, where the water temperatures and depth are much colder. And the red tide out there has actually adapted to those cold water conditions.
Hmm.
But so far, so good. So if you have enough circulation, enough sort of modification with wind and current and temperature, generally, the red tide is basically something that comes out of balance. So that's a naturally occurring algae that then goes kind of berserk. Typically, it's because an excess of nitrogen in the water, which is a big problem all around the country, but particularly in the Gulf, where the Mississippi just dumps out so much, you know, of the effluent from fertilizer and all the things that happen on the Mississippi from whatever, Minnesota on down. And that's often a big, big challenge. And you could see huge problems with water quality in Florida. I'm sure you were monitoring that.
Yeah.
Okeechobee outflows and all of the very manageable problems that unfortunately, you know, the sugar industry and other industries, agricultural in Central Florida, held enough sway that they could basically alter the water flow to their demands. And it would hugely impact both coasts in such a horrible way. It was such a catastrophe. And it's gotten better. That's the good news.
Yeah, but these are things that I think we need to continually have conversations about like we are today. And it's a learning curve and it's education for our listeners. It goes to really understanding how not only the environment, but how rules and regulations or lack thereof from our government or in an industry and just good old ethics and practices of how that can impact what you're digesting, which is an incredibly important part, not only of making you happy or unhappy, but also your pocketbook and everything else, because we all need to eat. And Carrie, over the course of your career, everything from, you know, at 11 Madison Park, I used to love to eat the pork belly that you served there. And people would say, oh my gosh, why would you go to this, you know, white tablecloth, very expensive, really high end, but incredibly delicious restaurant and order pork belly. But I have to say, not only the preparation, but when you source it from the right farmer, the right purveyor, that makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. And the one thing I would say to your previous comments is that time and time again, you know, dozens of time over, we realize that industries cannot be relied upon to regulate themselves. They will regulate in their own best financial interests. And if we don't vote to make the choices that will matter to us and more importantly to our children, because they're the ones that are going to inherit this continued cycle of challenge to the earth, challenge to the ocean, which then begets, you know, more warm waters and more, you know, lack of currents and all these, you know, sort of dangerous things that are certainly happening. We are all going to pay the price, and none more so than our children.
That's so true. And your beautiful sons that you have that we've seen grow up around incredible food, do you find that they ask dad questions about this kind of stuff, or is it just normal speak? Because what I find is when you bring these kinds of subjects into the household as parents, then it naturally educates the children and the next generation.
Absolutely. They're very curious about it. And, you know, I try and not make it pedantic at all. It's always been much more of a conversation that sort of relates to things they can feel and see in a tactile sense. In other words, you know, if there are less snappers and our oysters in our cages underneath our dock in Sag Harbor are dying, they're going to ask questions. They're going to say, you know, Daddy, why were you able to get striped bass so easily 5 years ago and now it's such a challenge? Why are there so many fewer snappers around for me to catch off the dock? Why are our oysters have a 70% annual mortality rate, you know, this year? And it continues to get worse. I mean, it isn't even if you have to lay on the big issues of sustainability and of water quality. It's there. It's obvious.
And so you're really talking about it's a real time and an immersive experience for kids to take them into those situations. Are, you know, a lot of times families don't have access to do those sorts of things. But, you know, that could be as casual as finding a public park that is on a water side and going and hanging out on the dock and having a conversation.
100%. And you could see, you know, year on year, the changes at that dock in terms of, you know, the water quality, the water temperature, the water clarity, even, you know, things that aren't scientific. Obviously, they're just sort of things that you could observe.
It really is about being a great observer of what's going on around you rather than kind of looking down at your screen every moment of the day, right? That's hard to tell kids that, but it really is important. Let's talk a little bit about your expertise, particularly in bivalves, and for our listeners, what that means is oysters and clams and all those things and how the environment is affecting that and what to look for when that ends up on our plate. Can you break it down for our listeners?
Sure. So we serve a great deal of oysters, probably 5,000 per week in each venue, mostly raw. And we get them from a variety of places, largely on the East Coast, because we like to say local, but we always have a West Coast offering. And the interesting thing about oysters is that they are probably the single most sustainable food, seafood you could eat, in that they contribute to their environment rather than detract from. And that's because they filter up to 8 gallons of water a day, so removing naturally occurring plankton and algae that, if left on its own, might overwhelm the environment and cause harmful blooms or lack of oxygenation, other things that'll just sort of set everything off and out of balance.
When people are deciding what kind of oysters that they're going to order at their restaurant or their favorite bar, whether it be a landlocked location or on one of our coasts, what are the things to consider? I know you said East Coast, of course, in Texas, there's the Gulf Coast.
Right.
The West Coast have a whole different. Now, I know, you know, I love Kumamoto's. And of course, that's a West Coast oyster. But I like lots of other kinds, too. But give us some tips what to think about when you're ordering oysters.
So basically, you would want to go with, obviously, the confidence in the restaurant to make sure they have the freshest and best quality oysters available to begin with. And further to that, if you're sitting at the oyster bar, for example, you can sort of, you know, watch what he's shucking and see what looks good and certainly ask him. I mean, he's kind of like your fishmonger / sushi chef in that he could give you, you know, up to the minute recommendations of what he finds, you know, most exciting.
It's sort of looking, seeing, smelling, all the above. What about going to our local market or the fishmonger at the seafood shop? You know, you've given great tips in the past that when you're buying fresh, of course, look at the quality of the eye of the fish and those sorts of things. How does that apply to oysters? How do you know when you're looking into that glass counter and they're there on the ice? What are we looking for?
So number one is that there's absolutely no gap in the shell. In other words, the oyster wants to protect itself by remaining tightly closed. And that was the sound of my hand clapping to imitate the closed thing, which doesn't play on radio.
That's okay. We got you here.
So that's the most important thing. You know, the other thing is that if you can ask to feel them, and they should feel sort of heavy in the shell. They shouldn't feel at all light. And that would indicate that they're full of oyster liqueur and you know, recently brought to market.
So let's talk a little bit about something you're interested in now that is something simple before I let you go. I'm going to put you on the spot here that our home cooks, our listeners might be able to do if they want to not be fearful and go buy some oysters from their fishmonger and they want to make a sauce for that at home. What would you recommend? Not every, you know, I feel like red sauce is so overdone with oysters.
You mean cocktail sauce?
Yeah, cocktail sauce. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate cocktail sauce. It's horrible. It is masking to me everything about the oyster. I would say just have some fun. You know, the two easiest things the three things you can put citrus, so lemon or lime or both, a little citrus zest, heat. Everybody likes a little spice, and you can put that in pepper flakes or your favorite fresh pepper. To whatever degree, I like habanero, but that's just me. And then, you know, any kind of an herb. So a little basil, a little dill, a little tarragon, some chive, all the above. Just minced together in a quick little mignonette and just a tiny teaspoon of that, you know, with a raw oyster. can make it, you know, so exciting.
Oh, it sounds incredible. I love a good mignonette. And I think that the name of that sauce is what scares people. But really, you're just talking about a little vinaigrette of what's fresh. And it's a balance of acid and heat and spice and what you have in your kitchen already.
Right. And you don't have to make it any more complicated than citrus juice, chili, and herb.
That's it. Boy, you're really speaking to a Texas audience when you say that, because we'll put that on anything. So That sounds good. Well, Carrie, we're looking forward to having you as a recurring guest. I'm going to put you on the spot of keeping us updated about what's new and what's happening in the world of seafood and beyond. Also, congratulations and your continued work that you do for all the organizations like Share Our Strength and others. We're so happy that you're still in that. You have been supporting them for so long. How many years has it been?
Yes, City Harvest Food Council. Really the big one right now. I mean, the New York's food insecure, it continues to grow, unfortunately, and the current federal policies are not helping that at all. You know, it's nothing more gratifying than being able to help your literal neighbors. So we're most chefs that I know are very proud to, you know, be a part of that.
Well, Carrie, thank you so much for being on the show today. And we will, of course, be checking back in with Chef Carrie Heffernan. I look forward to seeing you soon. And my mouth is watering from our conversation, as usual. Say hello to all our mutual peeps there in New York City. And we got to get you to Texas soon.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a good one. Thanks, Carrie.
Cheers. Bye.
Whether it's a plane, a train, or an automobile, make your way to this culinary destination.
So we have a really delicious pick for you this week. It's the Taste of Chicago, or just The Taste, if you're a local. Now here's the really cool part. It's the world's largest free admission outdoor food festival. This incredibly fun and delicious event is held for 5 days every July in Grant Park. You can buy as many food and drink tickets as you wish for tastings or full servings from over 80 local restaurants, pop-ups, and food trucks who are always there. And that's just on the food side of things. There's a wide variety of performances, including dance and other fine arts. You name the musical style and you'll see it performed at this festival. From big name chefs and globally known music artists to locals serving the original taste and sounds of Chicago. This Grapes, Grains, and Grub culinary destination pick is really a multi-palate and multicultural blend of flavors and experiences. So put on those stretchy pants, come hungry, and really take advantage of public transportation to fully enjoy the taste of Chicago.
And now, here's Cecily's picks.
So let's get right to it. Today, I have something to read, something to drink, and something to eat. So my first pick is Ama, a modern Tex-Mex kitchen. And these are the recipes in chef and restaurateur Joseph Centeno's new book. It's published by Chronicle and they've done really beautiful work here. It's unlike any authentic Tex-Mex recipes I've ever seen. Now, I grew up in South Texas and Mexico, and I can tell you firsthand that Tex-Mex is its own cuisine. And I'm thrilled that once what was referred to as kind of a one-off or a distant cousin of authentic Mexican food is now proudly standing on its own. Chef Joseph Centeno and I have a couple of things in common. We're both originally from San Antonio and went to New York City to hone our professional skills and also planted a footprint in Los Angeles. And his is pretty big. His mad skills were honed at some of the best globally known restaurants in New York before he followed his ingredients that he was so interested in. He followed them to California. His restaurants in Los Angeles are truly unique and has a very, very loyal and sincere following. He joined forces with a noted journalist. She's the former deputy food editor of the Los Angeles Times, Betty Halleck, and a really talented photographer, Ren Fuller. You'll find over 100 images in this really beautiful book. It feels more like a coffee table book to me than a cookbook. I highly recommend it. It feels very sentimental, but modern at the same time. So let me give you an example. These recipes really are a modern take on common dishes that you would find in home kitchens throughout South Texas. For example, I won't mention the name, but I think you know what I'm talking about, is a processed cheese block that is usually used in queso, but Chef's Take is vegan. Okay, that's all I'm going to say. You're going to love this. It's full of healthy, spicy flavors for the meat dishes, the tacos, and so much more. Congratulations, and I highly recommend Ama, a modern Tex-Mex kitchen. My second pick is an aperitif. I love a good aperitif. I don't know why we don't do them more. So this one is called Lo-Fi. It's the Lo-Fi Dry Vermouth. Today, I'm going to tell you about this and why I love it so much. This is a great dry vermouth to have right before the meal. You know, the Spanish do this all the time. And I feel like vermouth has long been misunderstood. It's actually a fortified wine, but I feel like here in America, we think of vermouth as a spirit that's used in martinis, just a teeny bit in martinis. And usually it's tucked away in the back of your bar and you forget that it's there. But my pick is the Lo-Fi brand. Now, I'll explain the name in a minute, but trust me, this is a refreshing sort of a craft take on this wrongly long thought stodgy drink. So this company was founded in San Francisco in 2016, so it's fairly new. Lo-Fi is a collaboration between the world's largest still family-owned winery, which is, of course, Napa's E&J Gallo, and this really cool guy called Stephen Gross of Quaker City Mercantile. Now, he is the same talented designer that turned product development mastermind, I think, behind brands he created like Hendrick's Gin, Sailor Jerry Rum. So yeah, he knows what he's doing. And as the name suggests, the brand is a music forward and it hosts live music series in the different markets they're in. I know they've done one, at least one in Brooklyn and other markets. You can find out about it on their website. But they do this for emerging artists in each city where they operate, and they have a really cool Spotify station. Of course, that link is also on our website. So even though this is a dry vermouth, it's a blend of muscat, Canale wine, Chardonnay, and grape spirits from Napa. It has a bit of a sweet finish, and here's the kick. It's got notes of botanicals and herbs that are like fennel and cardamom, and I'm picking up a little bit of maybe like a peach or an apricot flavor. So you can mix this with a variety of things. I like it almost like you would have a dry sherry before your meal. And really, you can ask your local bartenders about it because it's all the rage. But really, your best bet is to buy it online. I love it. So my next pick is Sonoma Creamery Cheese Crisps. Cheese crisps. The Parmesan flavor. All right. I have a story for you. Do you ever, if, I don't know, people out there that travel a lot, especially in and out of the same airports. So I am in and out of LAX all the time, going to Los Angeles. And of course, being Los Angeles, they have a wonderful store that has all, really, I would say organic, natural, gluten-free, good-for-you products in it. And I have this ritual that every single time that I'm leaving LA, I buy a bag of these crisps to eat on the plane instead of that processed, icky stuff they give you on the plane. So anyway, I'm kind of addicted to these things. Now, this company was founded in 1931 in Sonoma. They make cheese. But recently, maybe 5 years ago, they started making these crisps. All their products are gluten-free, certified, and they're high in protein. Now, they only use the milk from, you know, the same milk in their cheeses, obviously, that they put in their snacks. And it's all artificial hormone-free, which is great. So these crisps, they've got lots of flavors, but I like the Parmesan, has very few ingredients. So it's obviously the Parmesan cheese and then all organic quinoa, oat bran, and brown rice. But I'm telling you, these are so good and crunchy and crispy, and you really taste the cheese. But they believe in a simple concept there. They use the best milk to produce the highest quality cheese. And pretty much that's it. I like what they say, which is that they avoid putting any ingredients in their products that they can't pronounce. I think that's really cool. But all of their products are free of preservatives and artificial ingredients. They make them right there at their production facility in Sonoma, where they have extreme stringent checks for food safety and quality, which is a great, great thing. And I love them. So there you go. My picks today. All right. All the information with the pictures, the links, everything you need to know to find out more about these picks of mine are on grapesgrainsgrub.com. Those were some fun picks, if I do say so myself. If you have a product, destination, idea, or location you want us to know about, just go to our site for all the many, many ways to contact us. We really would love to hear your picks, and you know, you might just hear them on the show. Part of the joy I get from being an interviewer and writer all of these years is that I always learn something in the process of bringing you the stories of these exceptional people. I hope you learned something too. You know, I grew up in South Texas, Acapulco, Mexico, in the Hill Country near San Antonio and Austin. But when I moved to New York City to follow my dream of becoming a writer many, many years ago, it opened up a culinary world of master chefs and ingredients that were taken to a whole new level. On Grapes, Grains, and Grub, it is our mission to bring you insights and information directly from the source. We are living in such an exciting time right now due to technology. Our perspective is more global, and that includes our culinary perspective. However, that also means that we must be more educated about where and how our food is sourced. Please make an effort to buy your food as close to the source as possible and start a conversation with the people in your local market. You can learn a lot from the butcher and veggie department people at your local market. I continue to have the great blessing to interview these incredible people, and you'll meet many of them on this season of Grapes, Grains, and Grub. And you really can get to know them even better on our website, where you'll find behind the scene pictures and extras. We even get pictures of them with their families and special moments in their lives. You're really gonna love it. We are at grapesgrainsgrub.com. Our hashtag is Agriculture Tastes Good, and please do sign up for our newsletter. You won't regret it. I'm so grateful for you listening. We will keep bringing you candid conversations with these really dedicated people who fill our plates, bellies, and souls. I'm Cecily Armstrong, and I'm having a savory egg pie filled with roasted veggies and Gruyere cheese, and I'm pairing it with a delicious white Burgundy for dinner. What are you having? Let me know before next week's episode. You've also been asking me to post the wines and recipes from the dinners, so we'll start doing that too. And hey, thanks for asking. Until next time, adios.
The Grapes, Grains, and Grub Show is produced by Nitex Productions. Nitex Studios Originals. The executive producer is Cecily Armstrong. Producer is Stephanie Lott. Associate producer Polly Moore and the team at Nitex Productions. Theme music and original compositions by Frank Castro.